Article 3 of the United States Constitution creates what's called the judicial power of the United States. It's a power to hear cases and controversies. That is, courts, United States courts, act like every other court. There has to be a plaintiff, there has to be a defendant, or maybe a prosecutor and a defendant. There actually has to be a real case involving real people and real disputes. And out of those cases and their resolution emerge sometimes great rules of law, great interpretations of our Constitution. Well, so it is that one of the most important cases involving individual rights was based on a wharf in Baltimore. And we'll talk about it this week. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. This week it's about Barron, Baltimore, and the Bill of Rights, Part 2.
Welcome to your Weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
William Davenport Mercer is a buddy of mine from the University of Tennessee, where he teaches some classes in the Department of History, some classes over at the law school. His interest is in early American history, early American constitutional history. And recently he wrote a book about a case that, I have to admit, sort of surprised me. The case is Barron versus Baltimore, and though it's extremely important in constitutional history, it's not one of those cases that you hear about. It doesn't have the tragedy of a Dred Scott, or it doesn't have the pathos of a Korematsu decision, or any of the other ones that you've probably heard of. But it's very important, and it turns out it's very important in a very theoretical and fundamental way. What do we think of? What do we mean when we use the word right, as in constitutional right, or maybe as in divine right, or something called a natural right? These were the questions that John Marshall and his court, in one of John Marshall's last major cases, were wrestling with, and their decision echoes down the centuries. Last time, we had gotten to the point of talking about the context in which the case is going on. If you didn't happen to catch last week's show, I'll refer you to our podcast site. Just Google your Weekly Constitutional. The podcast site's typically the first thing that comes up, and you can look for Part 1 of Barron, Baltimore, and the Bill of Rights. But even if you didn't listen, or especially if you didn't listen, let me just bring you up to date. Barron versus Baltimore was a case. It came out of Baltimore, the state of Maryland, where a wharf owner, a guy who actually owned a wharf where ships tie up and pay him fees to tie up, was mad at the city of Baltimore, mad at the state of Maryland for having diverted the river upstream of his particular wharf in order to improve drainage and do other legitimate, in fact, very important government work there in the city of Baltimore. But in so doing, they changed the flow of the river in such a way that they made his wharf unusable. And he did something. He filed an action that today we would call an inverse condemnation action. He essentially said, government, you have, through your actions, destroyed the value of my property. You have therefore taken my land, and under the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, you owe me compensation. Well, this was a novel question at this point because the Bill of Rights had only been applied to the national government. That is, it was only the national government that had to pay compensation if it did something like build a road or improve a harbor. It was an open question as to whether a state government, and remember, it was the state of Maryland here that was acting, whether a state government had to do the same thing. That issue went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. The court granted a direct appeal from the Maryland Supreme Court, and this all happened in the early 1830s, and it happened just about the time that Andrew Jackson became president, when other cases that you've probably heard of, the Indian removal cases, were being heard by the court, and there was a big question as to whether Andrew Jackson would actually enforce any decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. It turns out he didn't enforce that decision. He let a ruling against the state of Georgia just languish and effectively backed Georgia over the Cherokee Nation. Here's Bill Davenport.
They're betting on Jackson to back him up, and Jackson does. Georgia proclaims sovereignty over the Cherokee lands, and Jackson gets the Indian Removal Act pushed through Congress. And so the Cherokees realize that their treaty partner, the Americans, have abandoned them. So they file suit. And this is, of course, you know, the two cases, the second one being Worcester v. Georgia, where the Georgians say you have to have a license to live on Cherokee land. And Sam Worcester and Elizur Butler, the two missionaries of pretty sturdy stock, refuse to get one. And the Georgia governor has them arrested and sentenced to 4 years at hard labor. Mm-hmm. The missionaries, you know, are kind of getting the book thrown at them, you know, hope to accept the pardon and take off. But they say, no, we'll do the time, which puts the Georgia governor in a really, really tough spot. So by the time this gets to the Supreme Court in the Worcester case, John Marshall says, Georgia, you can't do this. You can't proclaim sovereignty over their lands. You cannot take these lands. We have treaties with them. The American government, the feds can do this. You cannot do this.
Supreme law under Article
absolutely,
6.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So this is the one I'm sure many of the people listening have heard. The phrase that Jackson supposedly said, that we have no evidence that he said it. John Marshall has made his decision. Now let him enforce it.
Right. But that's consistent with basically what he did, because he didn't enforce it.
And his administration attacks Marshall in the press. And it's one of these kind of limits of law moments. They get the decision in Worcester, and we being lawyers think, we won. Wonderful. They race back to Gwinnett County, and the judge says, I'm not going to enter it into evidence. But you have to, right? No, I'm actually late. I'm getting ready to ride circuit in those new lands we just got takes off. That's a real problem.
That's a huge issue, and I know that's not what we're discussing today, but that was the low point in our history for judicial review. Mm-hmm. Marshall had, of course, announced it in Marbury versus Madison, though it has many antecedents. He didn't create it out of whole cloth, as some people will say, but he announced it in Marbury and had not used it extensively throughout most of his tenure. He realized that it was still controversial, and this was the low point because, you know, courts can proclaim whatever they want, but if the rest of the government, and specifically the executive, isn't willing to enforce it, then it means nothing. In fact, the second low point was during the civil rights struggles of the 1950s, when a number of states were defying Brown versus Board of Education. And if Eisenhower had not stepped in and sent in federal troops to enforce those federal court orders, then we would have had a second circumstance, like the Andrew Jackson and the Cherokee removal cases. So in some respects, it's remarkable that judicial review even survived Andrew Jackson. Okay. So having said all of that, this happens right in the same period of time. So maybe Marshall is concerned he doesn't want to do something now that's going to give Jackson a chance to refuse to enforce him a second time.
Or think of, you know, he's ending his career soon, and he knows it. He spent his entire life building the power of this court from nothing.
Yeah.
And keep in mind that the Supreme Court, it hasn't always been the Supreme Court,
right?
You know, and what happens if you have two decisions that get ignored in 2 years?
Ouch.
You know, I think that's part of it. And so he is coming back in for the 1833 term right as that episode is kind of coming to a whimpering end. Van Buren is able, Jackson's second vice president is able to kind of diffuse the situation. I think the other thing historically that I think is kind of weighing on his mind here is somewhat of a spatial point. You've been to the Capitol, you've been to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
You see the old Supreme Court chambers.
Oh, yeah, down in the basement.
Yeah, it's in a basement.
Yeah. They were definitely the redheaded stepchild of the three branches, yeah.
And like if they would put on their robes, they would do it and people could see them putting on their robes. They don't have offices. They would meet in their boarding house. I mean, it's definitely – the Supreme Court is a process. Directly above the Supreme Court chambers that were in the Capitol building, directly above – was the old Senate chambers.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening the same exact time that Marshall is dealing with Barron, John C. Calhoun is directly upstairs thundering against what was pejoratively referred to as the force bill.
Oh, the secession crisis.
Nullification. And
yeah, excuse me. Yeah. Nullification crisis, right.
Well, it was going to be secession.
It was going to be secession, but it didn't quite get that far.
So you've got the ending of the Cherokee mess. And at the same time, you've got South Carolina and the federal government that are heading for a showdown, with South Carolina feeling that the tariffs to support manufacturing and to cause manufactured goods to be higher was a way that the Southerners and South Carolinians had to pay more to protect protect the North.
Let's pause on that a little bit. Okay, you've got industry in the United States. Mm-hmm. Most of that industry is in the North. Mm-hmm. Most of the Southern economy is agricultural. Mm-hmm. The federal government decides that it's going to assist the development of American industry, again, most of which is in the North, by imposing tariffs on imports. And so, in other words, you're going to protect an American weaving factory, mm-hmm. Some sort of textile factory, from competition over in England. Mm-hmm. By making British imports a little bit more expensive, and therefore the American company will survive or flourish or develop. Okay, well, that's fine for that American company that wants higher prices for its products. But when you shift focus down to the South, where they're not producing much industrially, they're the people who are consuming these products. They're the people who might go out and buy the textiles or whatever else. They don't like this at all. They're just paying higher prices for all those Northerners to have bigger factories. So that's the basic North-South conflict over tariffs, which went back and forth all throughout the early 19th century. Mm-hmm. What happened then to prompt this nullification crisis?
You've got this tariff that is going to raise prices on manufactured goods. But I think to understand it and to think, you know, why are they getting so heavy about this? Or when I talk to my students, as soon as you mention tariff, there's a sense that they want to turn off and say boring. I'm like, no, people are going to...
This is a big deal.
People are going to start threatening to shoot at each other in a moment. So please wake up. The price of cotton had been tanking for over a decade. And so they're kind of already a little bit upset about this anyways. Mm-hmm. And it seems like kind of the final straw to them.
And whenever vast economic forces are at work and you're on the short end of it, it's tempting to find some sort of scapegoat. It is always tempting to do that, okay?
Yes.
So that's you're setting the stage there. So things have not been going well in
things
the cotton economy.
Not going well.
Okay, then what happens?
So you have this tariff that seems to inflame them, which in many ways was an election era thing. It was largely done to try to get the middle states on board with Jackson, knowing it would really inflame New England and the South, but knowing that the South's going to be in Jackson's corner anyways, and New England's not going to vote for him regardless. Let's try to target, Pennsylvania and the middle states. And South Carolina reacts in really, really big ways. And so what you've got is a really interesting situation. In Georgia, you've got the state affirmatively flaunting federal treaties and taking over land, and the federal government doing absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Cross one river, as John Calhoun noted, you have the federal government saying, look, if you won't collect these taxes, we're going to send the military offshore, of course. But to do so, we're going to enforce law. And
that's exactly what South Carolina had said.
Yeah.
It had said, we're not going to collect your damn tariff. Mm-hmm. And Charleston, of course, is the port in the South.
Okay? Oh, yeah.
So where the tariffs are being collected.
Yeah.
And they're saying, we're not going to pay your damn tariff, and you can't make us because we hereby nullify the tariff in the state of South Carolina. We're not going to obey this federal law.
Yeah.
Now, that's in direct contravention of Article 6, which says that federal law is supreme law of the land. South Carolina is saying, we're not going to do it. You can't make us do it. Jackson actually goes to Congress and gets a bill passed to specifically authorize.
Absolutely.
If indeed he did. It was called the Force Bill, wasn't it?
That's what they refer to it as,
uh-huh.
And what makes it so interesting is it's not just you're not going to do the tariff in our state, but every public office holder, judge, et cetera, of the state of South Carolina has to swear an oath to the state of South Carolina. They have to promise not to enforce this federal law, or you'll be stripped of office.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with William Davenport Mercer, the author of Diminishing the Bill of Rights, Barron versus Baltimore and the Foundations of American Liberty. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll continue our discussion with Bill Mercer. Stick around. Once again, the lone figure of Doug Smith walks in and darkens the window leading in to the broadcast booth at the Potter Studios. There he is. Doug, welcome to the show.
How are you doing, Stuart?
I'm doing extremely well. I'm betting that you're here to give us a quiz.
I am. Actually, this week we're doing a riddle.
A riddle?
And let me tell you something, not an easy one.
Really?
Not an easy one.
Is it a rhyming riddle?
There is some rhyming.
There's some rhyming?
I've been listening to Hamilton a lot, and so I've been speaking a lot of rhyme.
Is this a hip-hop riddle?
It's not hip-hop, but it's something worthy of Aaron Burr, sir.
Okay. One of these days we'll have you dance. Okay, who do we have on the line?
Hi, this is Logan.
Logan, where are you from?
Currently Washington, D.C., but originally Roanoke, Virginia.
Oh, so you're a Virginian, and what do you do in Washington, D.C., if I may ask?
I am a legislative director for a member of Congress from California.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you can tell us. Who's your congressman?
Jared Huffman represents the most beautiful part of America along the North Coast.
Oh, that is a beautiful area of California. Well, that's just marvelous. Well, we do need a hard one then, because Logan is an expert.
He's an expert.
He should be an expert. He works for Congress. He needs to know all about the Constitution. So let's give him a hard one.
All right, Logan. Well, I'm going to read the riddle, and then I'm going to give you four choices. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
The vice and the cabinet have power untold to replace a sitting president if they need to be bold. If capabilities are fleeting or health is at risk, 1.5 provides a path that is brisk. Which constitutional amendment does this refer to? Is it A, the 10th Amendment, because the vice president is a naturally born person? Is it B, the 14th Amendment, because equal protection includes protecting a president from her or himself? Is it C, the 23rd Amendment, because Washington, D.C. can replace the president in times of sickness? Or is it the 25th Amendment, because the vice president and half the cabinet can force the president out?
I'm going to go with D, the 25th Amendment.
You went straight to the 25th. Why the 25th Amendment, Logan?
You know, for some odd reason, my friends and I have been discussing this scenario recently. Maybe current events have been inspiring us to brush off the Constitution and figure out, kind of, in case of emergency, break glass.
I see. Well, I won't get into exactly why this is a matter of discussion these days, but we don't wish to be partisan here, but you're correct. The 25th Amendment it is the 25th Amendment, and I'm laughing here because, first of all, Doug, that was really great. I have to say, most of your rhymes really stink, but that one was actually quite good.
Well, what I wanted to convey is, you know, that when the vice president and a majority of the cabinet or another group, you know, signified by Congress, makes the decision, they can pull the chute.
They really can, and it has been a matter of discussion. And did you know it's also the 50th anniversary this year of the 25th Amendment?
That's true.
I just spoke with a guy by the name of John Furyk at Fordham University Law School all about this, and spent an entire episode on this subject because it is so important, not specifically because of who's president right now, but in general, it's very, very important to determine exactly what happens when the president dies. The original Article 2 was not that specific about whether the vice president was going to be an acting president or actually be the president himself. And it didn't say anything really about what the definition of disability or who decided that there was a disability. And so the 25th Amendment goes into great detail about that. And as you said, Doug, first the cabinet and the vice president, then the president himself can weigh in. And then ultimately, if they disagree, it's two-thirds of Congress.
Two-thirds of both chambers.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that in some ways the vice president could take over the presidency pretty easily. I mean, it's just like 8 members of cabinet.
Right. But then the president could basically nullify that.
That's right. The president then has to appeal to the Congress and say, no, I am, you know, suited for the job still. I'm still capable.
Right.
Not incapacitated. But even then, the vice president can yet again appeal, and then the Congress has to make that decision.
It is a very, very specific set of circumstances, and I'd encourage everybody to go out and read it because it is an important question. But as someone who works for a member of Congress, I'm very proud that you immediately knew the answer to that question, Logan.
Great job, Logan.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. So send us a message via Facebook or send us an email to ywc@montpelier.org and give us your T-shirt size. And we and your mailing address, and we will send a T-shirt to you along with a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
All right.
Thanks, Logan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Hey, you bet. It's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
And this is your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is William Davenport Mercer of the University of Tennessee, where he teaches in both the History Department and at the Law School, which is where I met him. Last summer, I asked Bill if he would come and tell me something interesting on my radio show, and he said, sure, I've got a whole book to tell you about. It's called Diminishing the Bill of Rights, Barron versus Baltimore, and the Foundations of American Liberty. That's a mouthful, but at the heart of it, of course, is the case of Barron versus Baltimore. It involves a wharf in Maryland, and whether improvements that were made to Baltimore Harbor and the rivers surrounding it had effectively taken the wharf from the wharf owners, and whether they were entitled to compensation. But what Bill and I discovered as we sat down to discuss this one case was that to really understand it, you have to put it all in context. So we've been talking about Andrew Jackson, we've been talking about the Indian removal cases, and most recently we were talking about the nullification crisis of the early 1830s when those troublemakers down in South Carolina were trying to nullify the federal tariff.
Other historians have noted this. You know, how is it that South Carolina, especially by the time of the Civil War, is just so extreme? And in many ways, you've got this incident where Union men are really being purged from South Carolina political life because of this. Jackson, of course, being Jackson, the political and the personal tend to get overlapped. The fact that it's John C. Calhoun, who was his former vice president, with whom there is no love lost, it comes out as the one who ultimately seemed to be orchestrating some of this, though in many ways he was, I think, just trying to stay ahead of the political winds in his own state.
Right.
Made this intensely personal. You know, the idea of if any Union man is harmed in Charleston, I will go down there, Andrew Jackson, and hang the first nullifier I see from the first tree I find.
That is remarkable.
People are very, so tempers are flaring, so to speak.
Right.
Let's put that all into consideration with Barron.
But before we get there, okay. I want to finish the story.
Yes.
I mean, South Carolina backs down. South Carolina
South
says,
Carolina.
Okay, we'll do what you need. But then, of course, they cut a deal, and eventually they lower the tariff.
Everyone has a way to save face. They lower the tariff over time, though they withdraw their nullification of the tariff. But they ultimately do nullify the force bill just because they won't, they're South Carolina trying to make a
understood
point.
But this, since there was no force was sent,
it was a face saving thing.
So everybody backs away from this, and this is often seen as the first potential secession crisis, because if things had gone further, if South Carolina had stood up, if Jackson had actually sent his armies and navies down there, I mean, we could have had Fort Sumter in the 1830s rather than the 1860s. Mm. So this was a backing away.
Yeah.
And to the extent that the tariff issue was resolved, then that also informs and gives the lie to the idea that the Civil War itself was about tariffs. The tariff issue had been more or less resolved by the 1830s. The Civil War was caused by slavery, which led to secession, which ultimately led to the war.
Oh, yeah.
And we've discussed that many times in this, but I mention that in passing because so many people will say the Civil War was caused by a tariff dispute. No, that had been more or less resolved, even though it was still a sore point.
Oh, yeah.
Subsequently.
Let's be very clear about that. There's no question about that. And plus, I think part of even the tariff dispute in South Carolina, why are they essentially, to quote The Godfather, why are they going to the mattresses over a tariff?
Right.
And part of it is, are you really going to give the federal government kind of regulatory power in certain areas that you don't want them to have? Where does this lead? The idea that the federal government needs to stay out of your business.
Right. It leads exactly where John Marshall wanted it to, which is the supremacy of the national government.
Absolutely.
So that was really the philosophical difference here. I mean, John Marshall was a nationalist. John C. Calhoun was the quintessential states' rights kind of guy. Mm. And so that was the underlying philosophical difference between them. But I guess I just want to pause here and say that in these two cases, in the early 1830s, Jackson is simultaneously someone who will not back up the Supreme Court in the Indian removal cases. And so in that sense is undercutting federal power, at least federal judicial power. but then at almost the same time is asserting national power, absolutely, at least the power of the national executive, that is his branch, mm-hmm, when anybody dares to stand up to him. Absolutely. And that's John C. Calhoun. So a little schizophrenic here, okay? A little bit inconsistent here. It doesn't seem that President Jackson has any sort of controlling philosophy except don't make me angry.
Well, in some – and I've thought about this a lot, and I think you're right. In some ways, I think – there are enough instances that we could talk about with Jackson that the personal is oftentimes what drives it. But I also think maybe if you want to say, you know, what's the difference between the two? And Calhoun noted, yeah, what is the difference? Federal law applies here but not there. I think he had a hard time dealing with a sovereign nation within a sovereign nation. I think that was a real problem for him, and some other historians have noted that. And I think
you mean the Cherokee Nation.
The Cherokee Nation. I think
so. It's simply his anti-Indian perspective.
Yeah, and I think it's not just simply, you know, I don't think we can chalk it up simply as kind of something we would say is just a racist idea. I think say what you will about Jackson, but the guy spent his entire life fighting for the Americans and taking shots for the Americans, even from as a little kid. Mm-hmm. And other historians have noted this, but the idea of a sovereign nation setting itself up within a state of the United States is something that I don't think he was going to tolerate for a second. And I think he was just more than happy to let Georgia do what he was going to do. I mean, I don't agree with this point of his, but when people raised, and the opponents to the Indian Removal Act raised the idea of, you know, essentially, what are you doing? He said, and at first blush, it's amazingly offensive. He said, well, I'm trying to save their culture. He said, what are you talking about?
Save their culture?
Yes.
Native American
culture.
And
he said, yes. And they're like,
okay,
what are you talking? And just try to not make him a caricature. He says, well, look, you know, what happened in the Northeast? He said, you know, what happened to the Narragansetts and the, you know, the Pecanicets and such? He said, you know, their cultures were, you destroyed them.
So they're going to be better off in Oklahoma?
I don't think so, but I think
But that's what he was thinking, or
yes,
he was maintaining?
Yeah, no, that's what he was meaning.
Yeah.
Now, whether you believe him or not is a different story.
But
Jackson is an intensely complex guy.
Yeah.
And has intensely complex ideas. Why did he do what he did? Why did he enforce one and not enforce the other? I don't know. We could go back and forth on that all day long.
I think it all boils down to the fact that he had how many pieces of lead in his body from previous duels? I think maybe just depended on which bullet was bothering him on a given day.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, he's a pretty ornery guy.
What, he was an ornery guy.
What is it? One historian referred to Jackson as darkness personified.
That might be true.
So, there's a real range of thought on that guy. Jackson also depends on who, like when you're studying history, in some ways is kind of tells us more about who we are now than it does the subject. I mean, the book on Jackson was Arthur Schlesinger's, and it was largely sympathetic because, you know, in progressive era historian, the idea of a guy, the common man, taking
common
on
man,
special interests, kind of resonated with that generation. And like a couple of pages on Cherokee removal. But now that we look at it, we're like, God, what a horror show. How on earth could you have done this? This is a national shame. And so he's viewed in a very different way.
Right.
So,
As a historian, and I as an amateur historian, someone who's interested in legal history, you got to remember that people are complex and that there's, you know, you can't engage in caricature and you have to put them in context. Okay, but we've talked a lot about
enough of Jackson.
Andrew Jackson, one that's very important.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that by the time, between 1831, when the court grants the writ of error to the Barron versus Baltimore case, and 1833 when it finally gets there, John Marshall, toward the end of his career, he's getting old now, his whole legacy is being threatened by this crazy man in the White House, Andrew Jackson, who's undermining everything he spent decades building. So maybe he's reluctant to take on another major case. Is that it?
I seem to think so. I mean, that's my argument. I think it kind of lines up perfectly. Think about it. A year earlier, Marshall's humiliated. His court is humiliated. He has a decision, and nothing happened. And now he comes back for the 1833 term, and there's a attorney in his courtroom saying, the Bill of Rights, because now it's a Fifth Amendment claim, the Bill of Rights and the Fifth Amendment in particular apply to the states. The states have to observe these. At the same time, John
Calvin... once again, the Fifth Amendment is where we have what's called the Takings Clause.
The Takings Clause.
Eminent domain, that's fine. The government can take your property, but we have to pay you. Okay, the government has to pay you just compensation for your property. This was the city of Baltimore, which is a subdivision of the state of Maryland, that took, arguably, this property effectively by diverting water and destroying the value of Barron and Craig's property.
Mm-hmm.
That's their whole theory, and they're going all the way up to the U.S. Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And when they want the Supreme Court of the United States to apply that takings clause from the Fifth Amendment. Okay, so that's where they are.
Absolutely.
So what happens then?
So while Calhoun is upstairs talking about, the dissolution of the Union and Webster, Daniel Webster, gets up to reply, and everyone is enthralled upstairs in the Senate. In the basement, a litigant is asking the court to apply the Bill of Rights to the states, meaning South Carolina, you have to apply the Bill of Rights. Abolitionists who send things to the South, you can no longer confiscate and burn those.
So you keep mentioning all these really fascinating issues. We have to talk about that just a second now.
Yeah.
What people don't realize is that during the early part or the first third, the first half of the 19th century, the South was becoming more and more of a police state, or much of it was, and they were specifically regulating and prohibiting under terrible penalties abolitionist literature.
Right, speech and press.
Yeah. Right, and as you already said, they were chasing out anybody with Union sympathies,
absolutely,
certainly in South Carolina.
Absolutely.
And throughout the South, and to the extent that abolitionist literature was even being mailed down there through the U.S. mails, they were passing laws saying you can't do that, and the people who were found with abolitionist literature were punished severely.
Yeah,
and so they were doing everything that a totalitarian state would do to suppress free speech on an issue that they felt threatened the existence of their economic system.
Absolutely.
But if the U.S. Bill of Rights applies to the states, that would include the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom of speech and of the press. So that's a huge issue in the background of
absolutely
this, isn't it?
And also think about where this goes. If it applies, but then what happens when a state violates it? Now you've got the federal courts open for business for all sorts of problems.
All those overreaching judges.
The timing of all this tells me, why is Marshall making, in his last constitutional opinion, really such a gift to the states? I think he's saving his court.
Because Andrew Jackson would not have enforced it.
Right?
He wouldn't have done it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
if they had agreed with Barron and Craig and they had said, yep, you're right, now Baltimore, Maryland, pay these guys for the damage you did to their wharf, they would have said, no way. We're not paying. And Andrew Jackson would have just been cackling in the White House. Now, I'm not going to enforce John Marshall's opinion.
Yeah. What does that do to the majesty of the court?
Another blow.
A pretty significant blow. It's interesting. The case kind of comes and goes. When they go to argue it, if we recall the attorneys for Barron and Craig, they have the local guy, Charles Meyer, very good Baltimore attorney, and David Hoffman, who's the more famous of the two. Hoffman is a bit of a troubled guy to work with, apparently has somewhat of an ego.
Lawyer?
What?
Extraordinary.
It's crazy. He gets into a dispute with the University of Maryland over some money he's owed, quits, and doesn't even show up to the Supreme Court hearing. So kind of leaves Meyer on his own. So Meyer gets up, does his whole bit, gets done, and it's Roger Taney's turn to get up, and Marshall stops him. Says, no, I don't need to hear opposing argument.
And what?
Yeah. No.
He doesn't even want to hear.
Doesn't even want to hear.
From the state of Maryland.
Stops him, and then goes in and tells us all the reasons why the Bill of Rights don't apply.
So in other words, Mr. Taney, you don't even need to make an argument because I'm already going to decide your way.
I've got this. He actually, it's a pretty interesting, it's a pretty short decision, but it's a pretty interesting decision. I think Marshall is the last guy that I think you can get away with doing original intent without anyone giving you grief about it. Because he said, well, look, when they talked about the Bill of Rights and they ratified the Bill of Rights, there was never any talk that this would bind the states. And he knows that because he was in the ratifying convention. so he's like, well, okay, I get that.
When I did this, my intention, that's fairly authoritative, I suppose.
It's pretty authoritative.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is William Davenport Mercer of the University of Tennessee, who's written a really cool new book. It's called Diminishing the Bill of Rights, Barron versus Baltimore and the Foundations of American Liberty. This is part two of a two-part episode, so if you've joined us later, if you didn't hear last week's episode, I just wanted to let you know that you can go to our podcast site. Just Google Your Weekly Constitutional, and one of the first websites you'll come up with is our podcast site. Let's take a break now and then come back and finish our discussion with Bill Mercer. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with William Davenport Mercer of the University of Tennessee, all about his new book, Diminishing the Bill of Rights, Barron versus Baltimore and the Foundations of American Liberty. Just before the break, we'd finally gotten to the point of analyzing Chief Justice Marshall's decision in the Barron versus Baltimore case. And we were talking about the sort of analysis he was using in order to reach his decision.
But if you kind of look into, like, kind of read between the lines as to what he's actually saying, I think it's more interesting. And I think it kind of goes back to what you said kind of at the top of the hour. Said, you know, Barron versus Baltimore is one of these cases that's in the canon, but no one's really done much in-depth work on it. And I think part of it is because Marshall's decision is pretty modern. It kind of sounds like what we do now. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a right, you have to know what court it applies to. There's questions of jurisdiction. Like, I wouldn't talk about a right enunciated by the European Commission on Human Rights in a state case in Tennessee.
Right.
And he says, okay.
Well, you could do that. I don't think it would go very far.
Well, I say you probably wouldn't get very far. Yeah, that would be – you want your money back with that attorney.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. But I mean, think about the right in question. Right? So it's a Fifth Amendment right. You can't take my property without paying me for it. Okay, just because it's in the Fifth Amendment doesn't mean that that's where it comes from. I mean, this goes back to Magna Carta.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that it's in the common law. It's in natural. It's everywhere. It's kind of this.
So what you're saying, let me just summarize here, and correct me if I'm wrong, because mm-hmm. this is always the way I see Barron versus Baltimore. Marshall says, look, the national government we created back in 1787 mm-hmm. Is something new under the sun. People were concerned about it. They were concerned about its powers. Mm-hmm. And indeed, that's why we have a Bill of Rights, was to constrain that national government, that new Leviathan that we were all so concerned about. That's how everybody understood it at the ratifying conventions. It was a check on the new national government. It was never intended to apply to the states. And therefore, it's only going to constrain the national government. So unless there is some other source in your own state constitution that's going, maybe a Fifth Amendment takings clause in the Maryland Constitution, which I'm assuming there wasn't because they didn't argue it, well, then you're just out of luck. Mm-hmm. And that was the law of the land. And I think there was a fair argument to be made that that was, in fact, the intention of a lot of the people who ratified the Bill of Rights. So I think as an originalist idea that it was a fairly well-reasoned decision. Mm-hmm. But the point you just made is that, okay, fine, so we don't get it from the Fifth Amendment. We should be able to argue that there are other sources of rights. We all used to be Englishmen. That's our legal heritage. So let's look to the English common law and go all the way back to Magna Carta and say this is just not something that a government can do within the Anglo-American Absolutely. Legal tradition. Absolutely. And the Supreme Court could have decided that way. Or the state courts of Maryland could have decided that way. But instead, Marshall decided to say, you've asserted a right. It's based on this text in the Constitution. I'm holding it doesn't apply to you. Case dismissed.
Yeah, absolutely. Great point. I mean, that's exactly what they're saying. And, you know, I want to get across that I don't quibble with his premise necessarily that the Bill of Rights wasn't meant to apply to these sorts of, you know, wasn't meant to bind Virginia. I mean, Virginia, for example, where Marshall is concerned about trying to limit the federal government. They're not then going to pass something that's going to limit them too.
Right.
But that's not the question. The Maryland State Constitution has this provision in it, which is almost a verbatim copy of Magna Carta. No man shall be disseized of his property except by law of the land.
And what's the law of the land? Yeah, the English common law.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so if we think about the original Constitution, and one of the earliest kind of complaints was that there was no declaration or Bill of Rights attached to it. And think of like the Federalist, some of the writings that Hamilton talks about. He says, well, look, not only is it irrelevant because it's a government of enumerated powers only, but it could be dangerous. I mean, you're going to write all this stuff down and you're going to imply that it has powers that it doesn't, or you're going to write down rights that somehow imply that these are the only things that exist.
That's a grocery list that's exclusive. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and
those were Madison's objections as well, and the objections of many other people at the time. But I'll also just continue the thought. Mm-hmm. Since the basis of the Supreme Court's jurisdiction was the idea that we're going to consider constitutional issues. Mm-hmm. In some sense, wouldn't Marshall's opinion have to have some basis in the Constitution, even if he wasn't going to hold that the Fifth Amendment specifically bound the states?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the only reason they were in the Supreme Court was because mm-hmm. they were appealing a state decision, so there had to be some sort of federal constitutional basis to whatever Marshall said.
Yeah.
He would have had to bootstrap it somehow. Mm-hmm. You know, the vibe of our Constitution, you know, something that we've inherited in the English legal tradition goes back to Magna Carta. I mean, there would have had to be some federal constitutional basis to what Marshall said, but he decided instead to have a very uncharacteristically narrow reading of the federal Constitution. Mm-hmm. He arguably passed up at least a legal opportunity to extend federal power mm-hmm. to the states.
Mm-hmm.
And you're contending it's because of all – it's basically because of Andrew Jackson.
In some way. I think it's because of the early 1830s. You know, I think like this is the kind of case that shows up in, you know, 1803 as opposed to 1833. It's a different animal. Mm-hmm. And other scholars have noticed if you look at the course of Marshall's career, you know, the first third is where – really all the greatest hits are, you know, up to Gibbons
mm-hmm.
In the mid-1820s. And
Gibbons versus Ogden, you know, for all of you lawyers out there, okay.
And as it goes on, as he's not able to command quite the same authority as he once did, his decisions get much more cautious as time goes on. And I consider this absolutely as a product of when it hit.
Could it also just be old man syndrome? I mean, we all tend to get perhaps a little bit more...
Possibly. Yeah.
I mean, he was getting old.
Oh, his wife had passed away a year and a half earlier. He fortunately was in better health then, but had just an amazingly painful surgery to remove a bunch of stones, I bet was really pleasant in like 1832, I believe. Which, mm-hmm. I'm sure that was fun.
Kidney stones?
Yeah.
That's painful to kind of. Oh man, no modern anesthetic. Okay, yeah, say no more.
You're making me faint here. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So he's an old guy, and maybe he's just a little bit. And he's been slapped around by Andrew Jackson, and he's just not feeling adventurous, and so he does it in a theoretical sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now we finally get to maybe the ultimate point that you're making in your book is that this decision, Barron versus Baltimore, represents a selection. What are going to be the sources of our constitutional rights? Mm-hmm. Are we going to look to natural rights? Are we going to look to international law? Are we going to look to the English common law? And the answer basically is no. If you want to assert a constitutional right, the very first thing you got to do is you got to point to some text mm-hmm. in the Constitution, which is likely going to be found in the Bill of Rights because that's where most of them are. And you're going to have to say, okay, pursuant to that right that's enumerated in the Constitution, the government can't do this thing to me. And that's effectively the definition of a constitutional right now. In fact, some people would say we only have negative constitutional rights in this country, mm-hmm. and it all goes back to this case. Now, what do I mean by negative? Mm-hmm. It means that in order to define a right, we first have to start with what's commonly called state or government action. Mm-hmm. In other words, the government, broadly speaking, has to do something bad to us, something that we don't like. That's the first step in any analysis of constitutional rights, because it's at that point that I say, wait a second, whoa, you can't do that to me. Why can't you do that to me? Because I have a right that I can, an individual constitutional right I can assert to stop you. Okay, says the court. Harris, where's your constitutional right? Oh, it's right there. It's in the Fifth Amendment. Mm-hmm. Or it's in the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. Or it's someplace like that. And that is how we evaluate constitutional rights to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Government action starts it. Someone protests, points to text in the Constitution, and then the argument is joined.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very specific way to argue constitutional rights. And it all comes from here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why we don't think of Barron quite as much, because it sounds very, very modern. Because part of what I wanted to do with the book was explain why he looked at it in a certain way, but also to look at this case as kind of at the start of a bigger shift, the shift that you're describing now, this idea that where do rights come from? Well, in the early republic, generally you got a couple of places. You've got the common law, which is still the most important. You've got more kind of an inchoate kind of fundamental or natural law or natural right type foundation. You have people that are saying that rights come from written documents, which is the Marshall view and Barron. And then you've got a bunch of cases where courts seem to be blending them all at once, I've discovered.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I've seen is that the idea that rights are creatures of jurisdiction that come from written documents like Barron is very much in the minority in this era. But when you get to, say, by the turn of the century, by the turn of the 20th century, Barron is considered completely unquestioned, so right. Courts apologize if anyone thinks otherwise. I think Barron is the start of this shift of thinking about rights as emanating from written documents that you get if a court grants it to you, or if you have the right kind of jurisdictional things line up for you. I'm not pining for a day where you could go back and talk about natural law and natural right. Those lead to, in many cases, very oftentimes fundamental problems. Discrimination, for example, in all forms was often justified as it is kind of being part of the natural order of things.
Yeah, the problem when you untether yourself from some sort of document, okay, then it's basically Katie bar the door. It's anything goes. You can argue pretty much anything as a natural right.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I object to the overuse of the word right. I prefer, even though I don't think it's necessarily always followed this way or interpreted this way by courts, I prefer to talk about government power.
Yeah.
Versus individual rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like to talk about the government as having rights. Governments have powers, powers that mm-hmm. people have given to them in one form or another. And so, for example, I think that regardless of the merits of the federalism question, I think states' rights is a misnomer. Okay, mm-hmm. We really should be talking about states' power. That's mm-hmm. fine. I'm not saying states shouldn't be powerful. I'm simply saying that individuals have rights. Governments have powers. And it seems to me that Barron versus Baltimore is quite consistent with that idea. In mm-hmm. fact, it's saying you have to find that the government's done something, and then you have to point to something in probably the foundational law in the Constitution of the U.S. or of a state that says the government can't do that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, having said all of these things, most of the individual rights that exist in our Constitution, arguably all of them, can be characterized as negative. That is, checks on what the government can do.
Mm-hmm.
In those occasions where someone goes into court and tries to argue that they have a positive constitutional right, that is, they can go in and make the government do something for them,
mm-hmm.
typically they get slapped down. When people go in, they argue the state has an obligation to create educational opportunities for them, things of this sort, typically they get slapped down because we conceive of rights as negative, as checks on government, mm-hmm. rather than as something we can use to make the government do something.
Mm-hmm.
So I see the genesis of that idea here in Barron versus Baltimore as well.
Yeah, I mean, and kind of going to your point, I mean, the Bill of Rights and the way we perceive of rights is largely negative is, because of when we wrote the thing. I mean, it's very mm-hmm. much a product of the 1780s. And a lot of people have lamented, why is it that no one seems to be copying the American Constitution anymore?
Because it ain't the 1780s.
Because it's not the 1780s.
And there ain't no redcoats.
Yeah. And the idea of is having a government that only operates on negative rights still a good thing? I think also, I mean, the constitutional order is always evolving, but by virtue of the way the Constitution is written, the very difficult amendment process, it evolves through statute, evolves through case law, and we have these various workarounds that we've figured out how to use it. But that for a country that may be starting from scratch, I saw one article, I thought it was a great analogy. They said that the United States Constitution, it's like a computer, like an ancient computer with a really, really old operating system, but we make it work because we have a great IT department. We being the American people,
right.
like we know how it works. But if you're going to start fresh and you wanted to kind of go back and forth over what commerce meant for the next 250 years, or maybe not the shortest move, but I always think it's somewhat off topic, but I thought the scholar that wrote that did a great job, because we sometimes tend to get so hung up on the text of the Constitution itself as somehow being the magic, whereas what they were getting at is that, you know, we're the ones that make it work. You know, the kind of belief in the rule of law and the belief in constitutional government that operates within limits and some of those limits being rights. Like, it took us generations to get to that point, but we should never forget that it's not the Constitution that makes this work.
That goes to the ongoing debate between the so-called living Constitution, mm-hmm. The people who are typically on the political left, mm-hmm. Who want to broadly interpret and they don't want to tether themselves too closely to the original text, or the so-called originalists on the other side, or the strict constructionists, yeah. if you will, who at least say that they want to go back and talk only about the text and about what the original drafters of that text meant. There is a consensus in this country that you at least have to start with the Constitution. If you're a strict constructionist and originalist, maybe you don't stray too far from the text. Or if you don't find something in the text, maybe you say it's not there, end of case. But if you're on the other side of the judicial interpretation spectrum, you'd at least start there. And you'd say, oh, well, due process of law. Well, obviously it means this. Mm-hmm. And you might argue things that didn't even exist back in 1787. Yeah. Yeah. But at least you're starting there. Okay, yeah. You're starting with the document, and then you're diverging in how you interpret it.
It's an exciting time to be doing legal history, because regardless of what you think of the methodology, the ground has shifted, and history is more and more and more important in constitutional decisions. As a historian, I find it fascinating reading some of these, because unlike judges, you know, we as historians have been arguing about these points for quite some time, and we continue to argue, but when judges kind of do history, sometimes they make some weird points, and those now become,
indeed they do,
they become law, which is
really weird.
Which
exactly
is weird.
Well, here's my suggestion, yeah. Then clearly you want your book cited in as many future U.S. Supreme Court decisions as possible, so go ahead and send a signed copy to each one of the 9 justices on the Supreme Court. And since I'm sure they all listen to this show,
sure.
I will commend it to their attention, and they should definitely use it to inform their next significant decision.
And
absolutely,
I
individual rights.
That.
Once again, the name of your book is Diminishing the Bill of Rights, Barron versus Baltimore and the Foundations of American Liberty by William Davenport Mercer. That's available in bookstores.
It's available in bookstores. It's on Amazon. It's University of Oklahoma Press. It's available on their website as well. It's all over the internet.
William Davenport Mercer of the University of Tennessee. Thank you so very much for explaining this seemingly obscure and yet extraordinarily important decision to us.
I appreciate that, and I thank you for having me on. I caught your show driving up to D.C. to finish some research on this book. I was in Virginia, and I heard it, and hopefully if someone else is driving through Virginia right now, you've enjoyed it.
That's why we have our podcast, so those who want to listen to us can just Google Your Weekly Constitutional, and you'll find our podcast site, or you can go to iTunes and subscribe there. It's the modern age, Bill. Join it.
I've heard these things. I'm taping it on cassette right now.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to William Davenport Mercer of the University of Tennessee for telling us about his new book, Diminishing the Bill of Rights, Barron versus Baltimore and the Foundations of American Liberty. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. We're joined today by Wayne's lovely daughter, Claire, who's sitting with us in the studio, flipping me a peace sign and ignoring me while looking at her smartphone. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harrison. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.